This edition of Rockwired Radio Profiles is sponsored by Diamond Disc Audio, professional mastering at any budget, and Capacity Productions, the number one source for online promotions.
Diamond Disc Audio is a full-service multimedia company specializing in audio mastering services as well as mixing, CD and DVD duplication, video editing and authoring, graphic design, web design, and lots more. Let us help you put those finishing touches on your final mixes in the all-important mastering stage. Don't you want your project to be the equivalent to major label releases when it comes to volume, EQ, and compression? That's where we come in. We are dedicated to providing top-quality creative services and affordable prices to indie artists and music companies. Based in Nashville, we have many major credits and have worked on thousands of indie projects over the last 16 years. Visit our website now at www.diamonddiscaudio.com.
Get famous with a little help from Capacity Productions, a specialized service getting you more likes, followers, fans, and clients on all social networking sites. Capacity Productions is the number one source for online promotions with over 15 years experience. So what are you waiting for? Get famous with Capacity Productions. Check us out at capacityproductions.net. You're listening to rockwired.com, online radio that rocks. From Rockwired Sound in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of all places, this is Rockwired Radio Profiles with your host, Brian Lush. Exclusively at rockwired.com. On this special edition of Rockwired Radio Profiles, we give it up for veteran rock band and cuts from their forthcoming release. Stick around for more. Rockwired Radio Profiles is powered by Rockwired Media LLC, a limited liability company, and is sponsored by Diamond Disc Audio, professional mastering at any budget, and Capacity Productions, the number one source for online promotions. Please stand by. Still looking for that blue jean, Steve McQueen, prettiest boy ever. Welcome to the latest edition of Rockwired Radio Profiles, exclusively at rockwired.com. I'm your host, Brian Lush, and the music is out there. In February of 2013, Rockwired Media will release a special edition of Rockwired Magazine called Let Me Hear You Shout, featuring black artists and rock. Ever since the founding of Rockwired in 2005, this is something that we've always wanted to do, and don't know of any other publishers who are taking the time to point out the presence of black artists in the world of rock. It's going to be an exciting issue, and it will be available for viewing and for download at rockwired.com on February 5th, 2013. One of the artists to be featured in this upcoming edition of Rockwired Magazine is veteran rock band. From 1976 to 1981, the band was known as the Tantrum Band in Los Angeles. Throughout the band's run, they were always this shy of a record deal at a time when the notion of a black rock band was unheard of. In 1981, the Tantrum Band broke up, and in just a few years, the band Living Color would be hailed as a breakthrough, incorporating the same hard rock approach that these fellas did 7 years earlier. Now, the boys have regrouped and are calling themselves veteran rock band. Rockwired had a chance to speak with Maurice Ball and Alvin Grimes of veteran rock band regarding their coming back together and the years they spent in the LA music scene as a black rock band, and you'll hear all that in just a few minutes. Here is veteran rock band with a cut from their forthcoming release, Devil Song.
Down on the devil, lose your soul in a piece of glass, giving face to the old one for a hit. You'll up that ass, find a way. Oh, God won't desert you. Find a way, fight for your soul, yeah, find a way. spirit find a way. Give him control, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh Lord, yeah. Motel rooms, you get busy. And in them cars, and Alice too. Be your man, be your lady, to get her here. Ain't nothing you won't do. Find a way. Oh, God won't deserve you. Ooh, you gotta give him control. Find a way. Don't be discouraged. Find a way. Gotta fight for your soul. Let's get in G. Let's just sit here for a minute in G. Get in G. World's rough is a joke, y'all. And it's hell. Can tell you that. Cause it's a bunch of suits. Getting fatter while prisons fill with brown and black. Say it loud, say it louder. You can't have corrupt without the powder. Say it loud, say it louder. You can't have corrupt without the powder. Find a way. Ooh, God won't desert you. Control. Ooh, don't be discouraged. Yeah, you gotta fight for your soul.
That was Veteran Rock Band with Devil Song. Check out the band at ims-1.com or friend them on Facebook. Rockwired had a chance to speak with Maurice Ball and Alvin Grimes of Veteran Rock Band, and here's how the interview went.
Well, anyway, you guys were together from 76 to 81 under as the Tantrum Band, and now you guys are back as the Veteran Rock Band. So, talk about what brought you guys back on the same page to want to go after this, you know, rock and roll dream of yours.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Yeah, the rock and roll dream, you know.
the rock and roll dream is it's in my spirit, and I think I can speak to the rest of the guys that it's in our spirit. And we had the good fortune of finding each other and realizing a great part of the dream in Tantrum. And so, you know, I don't think we appreciated the dream that we were able to realize at the time because of our youth and all these other egotistical things that were probably going on. But when I look back at the music that we played, I mean, we were playing the best possible music. It was the best possible venue for my idea of rock and roll that possibly could have existed. I couldn't think of a better place. And of course, that situation happened. It was fantastic, and then it imploded for all the reasons that many bands implode or explode. And so that was the nature of it. And it wasn't until 15 years later that I realized the significance of what we had accomplished and just how great that was. And I'll tell you this, Brian, for that whole period for me, because I did not become a million-selling rock star, and because I didn't have, you know, $250,000 in the bank and living in $1 million home or $2 million home, I felt like a failure. And it wasn't until, like I said, 15, maybe 20 years later that I was able to look back at that period and realize that we've been extremely successful because, one, we've taken the risk that most people only dream of. We've gotten in the game. We were successful in the game. And we just had other challenges that came along. But the fact that we got out there, the fact that we got on a spaceship and flew to the moon is incredible in itself. And just because we didn't, you know, build a city there or something is a whole other story. So now that I look back at it, that was incredible. And then here we are today, you know, fortunately with the sanity and the blessings to continue the dream. But we're continuing the dream as we are today. It's not like we're trying to revitalize or restore or revive what we did in the 70s. And it doesn't make sense. We're starting anew in terms of songwriting and everything else. So, that's my spin on what happened then and where we are now.
How about you, Alvin?
Well, for me, coming up in Detroit, you know, it was like real hardcore rhythm and blues, or just hardcore blues. And then around about 68, I heard, around about 67, Sly and the Family Stone broke out, you know. And it was just such a radical sound, okay? And the thing that I loved about rock and roll was that it was dealing with issues. I mean, every month the Temptations were found my baby, lost my baby, got a new baby, where my baby, right? You know, and I don't get me wrong, man, I'm you cut me, I bleed Motown. But by the same token, I was like really turned on when I heard Jimmy say, "Excuse me while I kiss the sky," you know? I mean, that was such a radical concept at that time. Nobody was running around talking about kissing the sky, you know. Kiss the sky? How do you even conceive of doing something like that? So I started listening to rock and roll, you know, and I started playing bass, and I started playing rock and roll. So I was listening to Cream. I was listening to Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, you know. And they were political. Jefferson Airplane, political. These people were saying something about the war. They were saying something about injustice, you know, and the things that were wrong with society, and they were using music, and they were being like prophets, man. And I think each generation produces their own prophets. You know, we've had them in comedians, we've had them in musicians, artists, whatever, but they're like prophets. And I became consumed with that. You know, up against the wall, fascist pig, I'm going to wave my freak flag high. I mean, all of that really began to make sense to me. And you caught flack from it, from the black community, because they felt you were, you know, betraying your own kind by playing rock and roll. And then the white folks looked at you weird because you, it's like they thought Jimmy was the only person black that wanted to play it. So it was like, that's where my heart and soul is. I love jazz, man. I don't even listen to like this modern jazz. It's all like crap. I listen to bebop. I'm into Coltrane. I'm into Miles. I'm into Mingus. I'm into Monk. That's in my heart. But when it comes time for me to plug up my instrument, rock and roll comes out. Okay? It just comes out. Now, when we formed Tantrum, it was like four entities coming together. You know, Mark and I grew up listening, I mean, Reese and I grew up listening to Hendrix and Mountain, you know, groups like that. Then we hook up with Kent, who was like a jazz drummer. He was really influenced by Mitch Mitchell, okay? Then we hook up with Mark, and Mark was really influenced by Hendrix. So when these four things came together, and I was into Pappalardi, Felix Pappalardi, Jack Bruce, people like that. So when we came together, it was like phenomenal. You know, the stuff just started coming. The tunes, I mean, as a band, I think in that period of time, we wrote a partial opera and an easy 150, maybe 200 songs. You know, we were very prolific. We just didn't get signed. So when it broke up, it was like this tremendous vacuum in my life. You know, because you wake up every day and you say to yourself, what are you? I'm a musician. What's your purpose in life? I'm going to be a rock star. And I mean, and you did that while you ate top ramen and mackerel. You did that while you put cardboard in your shoes. You know what I'm saying? You did. it's what kept
and, you
know, going, man.
And you know, the thing about this, and I'm so glad you brought that all of that out, Alvin, because here's the deal, Brian. For me, you know, the experience that Alvin just shared with you is a lot of my experience. But at a very young age, when I was introduced to rock and roll and I saw images like Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Jimi Hendrix and Sly Stone, I felt like I had a right to play that music. So when, and I felt like it was a natural born right. And then when I did just a little bit of digging and, you know, realized that rock and roll music was really born from black folks, it was born from blues and
the church.
Race music in the church, yeah, all of that.
Yeah.
When I realized that, then as far as I was concerned, I had a natural connection and a right to do this. So, and even to this day, I feel that way. So it's just like somebody who was brought up in a family of doctors, well, they feel like, you know, I'm a doctor, I only have a right to do that. Sometimes I forget about the struggle that I had to go through and that people like us had to go through just being black. You know, sometimes
playing
I forget
rock and roll.
Because I always felt like I had a natural right to do it. It's what I was supposed to be doing. And if you felt otherwise, then, you know, the hell with you. You know, you're
yeah.
wrong. You're
Let's take it to
wrong.
The parking lot.
Stupid. Yeah, you stupid or something. I don't know.
You know,
and
what was really funny about it, Brian, was that we ran into a lot of opposition. When the four of us came together in California, you know, we were still believing in if we can all play music and understand each other, you know, we can work these things out. We can figure out that basically, man, there's no real difference between poor black people and poor white people. You know?
No, there isn't.
There's no difference among people.
Right, but if you let one get some money, then all of a sudden that becomes an issue. You know, and once again, it's about music for social change, music
right.
for spirituality, right? So when we came together as Tantrum, that's where we were. But the thing was, we were playing, like, you know, meaningful rock and roll during the long hair, big hair rock and roll days. When everybody was talking about doing cocaine and, you know what I'm saying? It's like the thing changed on us. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
We were singing about revolution and freedom, and the rest of the bands were singing about limousines and bone and blonde. Okay?
Well, true,
so,
because Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Jefferson Airplane and many of those people were the foundation of what I knew to be rock and roll.
Precisely. And it had to have meaning, you know? I mean, all the groupies and the drugs, that went along with it, but that was not the primary reason why you strapped on a guitar. You strapped on a guitar because that was your way of waging war against injustice. That was your way of saying, screw this.
And that's how you made your
statement. Yeah, I resist this, and I use my music to resist it with, but I ain't above going to the parking lot. You know what I mean?
Right.
So when we broke up, And Reese and I both attested to this. It's this tremendous vacuum that you try to fill. You know, Reese went into business. You know, I've written novels. I've written screenplays, things like that. I went into writing. I went into drama. But it was still this ache, man, you know? So then, what, 2007, Kent got in touch with me, the drummer, got in touch with me on MySpace.
Was it
come to find out.
Nine?
Well, 2007. Because remember, I didn't move back to Detroit until 2009. And
okay.
We had done those tunes before then. So
right.
He called me up. My guitar was like most in and out of the pawn shop all this time, right? So Kent told me to come out to his spot and do some jamming. I hadn't played serious bass since 1981. So it's 2007. Now, I hadn't played serious bass, so I was really embarrassed. I'm like a fighter who's out of shape, right? And I jammed with him, and that week I came home and wrote a song called Ancient Time. And we went out, we laid the track, and then we sent it to Maurice, and Reese put some stuff on it, and we're like, whoa, we still have this. But this is now due to like things like Pro Tools, where you can, two people can get together, record something, and then download it to somebody else, and if they have the same equipment, they can, you know, they can put stuff on it, right? So then came about maybe four or five songs just came bing, 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 bing. So then I moved to Detroit, and we got in touch with Mark, who was living in Boston. Mark comes out here to lay down some tracks, and next thing you know, we're cooking. It's like we never missed a step, Mark. I mean, Brian, I'm sorry.
Brian,
it's
yeah.
like we never missed a step. And but oddly enough, that's how true friends are. You know, like, you can have a diehard friend. Y'all might not see each other for 20 years. But as soon as you get back together, the click just happens. It's a magical thing, man. So when we got together in 2011, the first time we'd ever been in the same room since 81, and we did 9 songs in 3 days.
Wow.
You know? And, yeah, and it's been going on like just jamming ever since, man. We're cranking out a lot of material.
Yep.
And it's
absolutely
brand new stuff.
And it's, and then there's no energy whatsoever that has anything to do with the word revival.
Yeah, because it's all new.
We picked up where we left off. I'm not even interested in playing the old songs, which are great songs.
Not really.
I see.
You know, the new stuff we got going right now is just so in tune. And what's really cool, Brian, is that what we were talking about then is pertinent now. When you look at our government now, when you look at what's going on with the patrician class, or the, you know, the Romans, as I call them, versus the mob, which is us, this stuff is back now. People are willing to get out in the streets, like you just saw that with the thing on Wall Street that went nationwide with protests. People are back into activism again, and people understand the need for it. So our music is now pertinent to what's going on today, and that's what we're talking about. So it's, I mean, God is great, man. I don't know if you're a believer or not, but I'm just amazed every day by how God is working this thing out, you know. Because by now, and all this time, any one of us could have slipped on a bar of soap and been out of here, you know.
Almost did it this morning.
Yes, right, you know. But here it is, not only did we not slip on the bar of soap, but we're coherent, we're still on fire, we still love the music, and we still love each other. You know, and that's a blessing, brother. That's a real blessing.
Yeah, and yeah. The year 2013 isn't exactly 1976, and you guys seem to be working remotely, you know. So describe how the songwriting process has changed with you guys from before.
Well, it's changed in a huge way, as much as our ability to actually get the idea sanely formulated into a workable workable solution and in game. You know, Alvin is the primary writer in the band, and so all he needs is an idea, and it's pretty easy to get that, say, in the Pro Tools, and just start building tracks from there. And I think we've done some songs in like hours.
You know,
it used to take days and weeks to kind of get it all out, and that's because we were, you know, under the influence of all kinds of.
You're right.
You know,
I like the way you said that.
Yeah. But so today, you know, we can, you know, get an idea down, send it to somebody else in the organization, and they can add to it or compliment to it or make some suggestions. And within a day or two, it's pretty much a finished sketch, we'll call it that. And that sketch is clear enough to where you can put it aside until we can all get together and actually mash it out in real time. So that potential, or the ability to do that, didn't exist before. And modern technology, or modern tech, as I like to refer to it, is a big part of us being able to do this today.
Because our biggest thing right now is the fact that we are so spread apart, in that it's, it's sort of like how Steely Dan was. They didn't tour a lot. They did a lot of material. They were in the studio a lot. they didn't tour a lot. In order to put together an act, though, you kind of got to be, you know, together.
Right.
And we're hoping that a way will open up for us to be able to, everybody be able to take off their jobs and put in a good 30 days. If we could get 30 days rehearsal in, preferably 2 days for 30 days, we would have an act that, in my opinion, I'll open for anybody. I wouldn't be afraid to open for anybody, because what we're doing, and I'm not bragging, okay, Brian? I'm not bragging. I hope I'm not coming off that way.
No.
But I would be willing to open for anybody. I don't care, Lenny Kravitz, Metallica, Rolling Stones, because the music is credible, and if we get an opportunity to put together an act, oh yeah, we can hold our own very well. Very well. That's the only thing right now.
Check out the band at ims-1.com or friend them on Facebook. The links are provided below. Here is veteran rock band once again with Almost Cut My Hair. You're listening to Rockwired Radio Profiles exclusively at rockwired.com. Online radio that rocks. Rockwired Media is pleased to present Rockwired.com's Artist of the Month, Frank Juan, and his debut solo EP, Born Ready. As a member of the group Nake Nulawaun, Frank has made his presence known as one of hip-hop's true thinking men. Now he takes the rhymes and rhythms a step further with music which incorporates tribal sound textures and lyrics with a more personal approach. With tracks such as Oil for Blood, Hoka, and Free Your Mind, Born Ready gives listeners a taste of great music to come. Born Ready, the solo debut EP from Frank Juan, Rockwired.com's Artist of the Month. Check out Frank and Nake Nulawaun at Facebook.com. Passionate, fearless, innovative. Gorgeous Media is an award-winning firm specializing in artist development, branding, creative consultation, event planning, music supervision, publicity, and talent management for all areas of the entertainment industry, from music, film, fashion, theater, and art. To schedule a free consultation, email us at info@gorgeousmediagroup.com or call us at 323-782-9000. That number again is 323-782-9000. Without a doubt, the future is looking gorgeous. Visit us at gorgeousmediagroup.com. You're listening to Rockwired Radio Profiles exclusively at rockwired.com. Online radio that rocks. Welcome back to the latest edition of Rockwired Radio Profiles, exclusively at rockwired.com. I'm your host, Brian Lush, and today we're giving it up for veteran rock band who will be featured in the February 2013 edition of Rockwired magazine called Let Me Hear You Shout, celebrating black artists and rock. Rockwired had a chance to speak with Maurice Ball and Alvin Grimes of veteran rock band, and here's how the rest of the interview went.
Going back to, 1976 to 81 is quite a stretch. I mean, 5 years is definitely some time in the trenches. So talk a little more about, and being as based in Southern California then, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, from what I understand, 76 to 81 was definitely, you know, Madam X and bands like X and, you know, and you know, the punk scene. So talk about how this, you know, call for revolution fit in with that sort of punk scene.
it didn't really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't really, and we kind of ignored those guys. You know, they were like, whatever.
Right.
That may have been part of our problem. As a matter of fact, Devo opened up for us.
Wow.
Devo opened up for us. And it was like, we were looking at them like, whatever. And so, you know, and then of course they went on to be more famous than a whole lot of people. And Mark Mothersbaugh is probably one of the most prolific
soundtrack people.
Yeah, soundtrack for television and movies. So yeah, there you have that. But we didn't really take it seriously, nor did we pay it any attention.
Because the thing was, man, we believed that what we were doing was right. Like, when I saw the Sex Pistols, I'm looking at Sid Vicious, and, I mean, you got E-A-D-G painted on your guitar? For real, man? Are you kidding me? The hours that I've sat in woodshedding, the blood that I've spilled, you know, just playing, getting my technique down, and this guy is able to get over, and he only played bass for 6 months, and he's got the notes painted on his damn guitar. Oh, man, are you kidding me? And, you know, I look at the Ramones, and see, what's funny about all this, that whole new wave punk rock scene, see, Reese and I are from Detroit. We grew up with Iggy Stooge.
Yeah, we'd already seen that in the best and in its extreme. So it's like,
Sex Pistols were a bunch of kindergartners by comparison to Iggy Stooge, man.
Right.
And we would see Iggy Stooge all the time. You could see him every weekend here.
And I remember being like 14 years old or something, and maybe even 13, and going to a concert, and Iggy and the Stooges were there, and that's not even why I went. but they're performing, and I will always remember him painting himself with peanut butter, and then diving out, you know, like it's called the mosh pit now, but it wasn't called that then, diving out into the audience, and everybody stepped aside, and he hit the floor.
Ooh.
And he fell on a beer bottle, and he climbs back up on the stage, his chest is smeared with peanut butter, the broken glass, and he's just continuing on with the show. Now, that's what I remember.
Search and destroy, yes.
I remember he jumped into the audience one time, and it was the middle of a bunch of bikers, and he started dry-humping one of their chicks,
and
they beat him bloody, threw his body back up on the stage.
On the stage, and he got up and kept singing.
He started singing, "Now I Want to Be Your Dog," and the band never stopped.
Right.
Wow.
So when I'm looking at the Ramones, and I'm like, you guys, what are you talking about? Punk rock began in Detroit. It did not
right.
begin in England. Are you kidding?
Right.
They wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes walking the streets of Detroit.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing, Brian, is like coming from a history. Ted Nugent, Detroit. Grand Funk Railroad, Flint, Michigan. You know, it was so much tremendous rock and roll in this town.
Right.
Yeah, and there were a lot of black people here also that played
rock and roll.
And yeah, they played in a lot of the bands were mixed generation, we could call it. Here, there a lot of them were. So when we got to Hollywood, you know, we definitely felt like we had a right to do this. What are you talking about? What's going on?
Yeah, why are you looking at me like I'm a reject from a petri dish? I'm playing rock and roll. And Reese is absolutely right, Brian. The type of city that Detroit is, see, it's five times smaller than Los Angeles. So everybody knew each other. And, like, I went to high school with Earl Klugh, okay?
Oh.
Ralph Armstrong was at Cass Tech.
Yep.
You know, I mean, as you look around, a lot of these cats we grew up with.
Yeah, Ray Parker was in the band at the other school. We didn't pay him no attention either.
Yeah, that was just Detroit. You're supposed to play this way. You know? So we get to Hollywood, and people are going, "You're a black rock group." We're like, "Yeah, we're a black rock group. So what?"
Yeah,
you know?
Like this whole thing is based on the three chords that Chuck Berry came up, isn't it?
Thank
you,
that's
right.
Right.
Yeah,
that's it.
What are you talking about?
Right.
Exactly.
So then we're running into situations where club owners don't want to book us. People are booing us when we're standing up tuning our instruments up, and people are yelling things like "Porch Monkeys" and "Go Back to Compton, niggers." You know, we don't want to hear no disco niggers. I mean, that type of stuff. You know, and it's like, I mean, we did biker gigs, man. We did gigs where city riots broke out. You know, and then club owners. Like, remember that time when we did that Battle of the Bands down at the Great Gatsby down in Belmont Shores, right?
Yeah.
We won it, okay, Brian?
We called them out.
I mean, everybody does it. We called management back and said, "Well, when are we gonna? You know, when are the finals?" They tell us, "Oh, well, we're closed down for remodeling." We go, "Really?" They go, "Yeah, we're closed down." The next week, they run an ad in the paper with all the bands that we beat.
Damn.
That's the type of stuff we went into, you know.
Well, we were playing. We were playing gig one place. Oh, I always remember this. Just since we're talking about races, we were playing a gig one place, and all these young white girls came running up to the stage. It was cool, you know. We weren't paying them any attention, and we noticed that after a while, their boyfriends came and literally dragged them by their hair back to the
right. Place. That was at the Proud Bird Inn. And that turned into a small riot. That's what I'm talking about. Because the white girls were fighting back. So we're playing, right? Right? And I'm looking out at the audience, and it's a fist fight going on between the girls and the guys.
Wow.
The girls ran up to the stage because, you know, we're like grinding our crotches at them and licking our tongues out at them and stuff like that. You
and
know?
The place is literally packed.
They had never seen anything like this. All the bands that were playing that night were top 40 cover bands, you know, like groups that wanted to be Foreigner or wanted to be Boston, you know.
Or wanted to be Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, and that's what we were competing with. We were doing all original rock and roll, by the way.
Quite well, huh?
Yeah, and what was so funny, I remember one night somebody hollered out, "Hey, man, play some Zeppelin," right? So Maurice says, Well, no, they were in town last night. Since they didn't play any of our stuff, we're not going to play any of theirs. I mean, so... great. Hey. So,
oh, that's right. And I said that in a biker bar.
Yeah.
I barely made it out of.
And that was crazy. You know, so... You know, I mean, there were times when we really had to go back-to-back and pick up mic stands and get ready to rumble because they didn't think we had a right to play this stuff. And then to make matters worse, they didn't think we had the right to play it as well as we could. So a lot of the local bands wouldn't do gigs with us.
No, they refused.
Wow.
You know, like, you know how bands will form coalitions and help each other out?
Yeah.
That was never extended to us.
Right, the coalition was always against us. Like... We did a series of gigs, and we didn't even realize what was going on. And we did a series of gigs. After every gig, we would always look around, and somebody from the other band would always put some of their equipment in our truck. And then, of course, they would say, "You guys are trying to rip off our shit."
Oh, jeez.
No, we're not. And so right. That went on for a while, so we had to create a security protocol to make sure that nobody else's gear went into our truck. We had to create our own protocol.
And then what was weird about that, the very band that would accuse us of stealing, we would end up short a mic stand.
Oh, all the time. We missed
it. Okay. We would end up short mics, right? So then the word got around that we're some kind of, granted, we were arrogant. Okay, yeah, that's true. That's very true. But, I mean, who isn't? You know?
Right.
Once again, I'm playing rock and roll. That's part of rock and roll, is arrogance. What, I'm supposed to be, Step and Fetch It? Are you crazy? I'm going to stand just as tall as Robert Plant. Because, see, once again, I wasn't scared of Zeppelin. Bring them on. Let's play with Zeppelin. You know?
Most important, we were raised up in an environment, Brian, that simply said that, you know, we had a born right to do this. And so I never really felt any different about it. And to this day, I don't.
Right.
So all of that, that would be like somebody telling Obama, well, you can't be president. He's like, what are you, stupid? I am the president.
What, you know, how many times did you fall on your head as a kid? I mean, you know.
That's, right.
That's where we were, and a lot of people didn't like it. Now, in retrospect, were there some things, was there a couple of slices of humble pie that we should have eaten? Hell yeah! Were there some people maybe we shouldn't have smarted off at? Hell yeah! Oh my God! Like that time when we had done the Starwood, and the only person, it was a club in L.A. called the Starwood, right? Huge club. And the owner told us after we finished, he said, the only person that has packed this club as big as you guys did was Rick Derringer. Okay? We had a line wrapped around the block.
Yeah, they had to turn people away. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It was a huge club, okay? So they told us that they wanted us to play again. And we said, fine. So we went out, and we had a real machine as far as publicity goes, T-shirts, flyers, the whole bit. So we went out and promoted it, and the week of the gig, they tell us, well, no, you guys can't play. So we were pissed off. We was hot as fish grease, right? So, you know, then they called us back from out of nowhere and said, can you guys play? And we said, no. Well, that was stupid. We should have played. You know, that was a club owner that, see, at that point, he would have been indebted to us. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But politically, it would have been the right thing to do. But we were like prima donnas. Oh, you're going to reject us, and now you expect, you know, no. You get your black butt down there, and you play. And you become the house band, if necessary. If you can become the house band, this is your venue. You know, it's the perfect venue for what we needed at the time. But we got all emotional. But we didn't have no management.
And then,
you know what I mean, Brian?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, management, like I was, what's that movie, That Thing You Do? Okay, have you seen that movie with Tom Hanks?
Long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, okay, it's a great film. I was just watching it today. I love that movie because those four guys were idiots. They didn't know what they were doing. They just had talent. They needed someone to say, no, you shut up and you show up here at 8 o'clock and do what this guy tells you to do. We never had management, Brian. Or at least that we could trust. And that's important because when you go to talk to club owners, they're not listening to musicians. Man, they don't give you the same respect that they do if you got a manager. when you want to go to a record company to try to cut a deal, they don't pay attention to you the way they do. The minute you say you've got an agent or some type of representation, you get props. It's just like trying to sell a screenplay. If you don't have an agent or a manager trying to push your screenplay for you, the major houses aren't going to look at your stuff. It gets thrown in a waste paper bag. And we never had management, and that hurt us. And we looked for, during that period of 76 to 81, we went through a lot of people who were fronting to be managers, perpetrating to be managers, but we never got a taste of the real thing. And it hurt us. It killed us, actually.
When did you guys realize that it was over? I mean, you know, the first...
Well, there were a series of rehearsals and experiences that, well, we were, I don't know if we were infighting, but we became disenchanted with the whole rigmarole of it all. Drugs played a big part of it. I mean, everybody was just high as hell all the time. And we just became disenchanted with the whole concept. And it just kind of, you know, so between that and the bickering and the fact that, you know, there's a cost of running a band.
Yeah.
You know, there's a cost, at least in Hollywood, there's a cost of a place to rehearse, there's a cost of keeping the gear up, there's just an ongoing expense. And then you add to that your booze and pot expense, and, you know, it's a real thing.
Yeah, and then another thing, man, it was like, it's, you have to fight to keep despair. Despair is like cancer, okay? And you can fight it, and you can fight it, and you can fight it, and after a while, you just get tired of fighting, you know? Now, the kicker on it, Brian, is this. We break up in 81, right? Living Color breaks out, what was it, 85, Reese?
Something like that, 85.
Yeah, 85 was their first EP or something like that, yeah.
Right. Okay, we were doing Living Color in 77, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, everybody's raving about Living Color, and I'm like, you got to be freaking kidding me. Now, I'm not saying they weren't a good band, don't get me wrong. Cult of Close Personality is a cold-blooded hit, okay? But we had that sound. In 77. We had that sound in 78.
Wow.
Right. But see, they had management. Also, they had the Black Rock Coalition. There was no Black Rock Coalition for us. We were the Black Rock Coalition.
or the Black Rock Idiots.
Yeah, whatever.
A lot of other people
up there,
yeah.
Yeah, or as they used to call it. They used to call us behind our back the nigger band, you know. I mean,
yeah,
but
right.
That's there was no support group for us. There was no place where, like, they had in New York, CBGBs, I think it was.
Yeah.
Where it was a club that was, you know, dedicated towards playing, you know, showcasing black rock. There was nothing like that in Hollywood. You know, and there was nothing like that in Southern California.
Right.
We were it. And see, that benefited in Living Color, of course. Going on tour with the Stones didn't hurt either.
No, it certainly did not.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I don't want to say that the door is necessarily wide open, because you can count, you know, the number of black rockers now on one hand, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You know. I mean, so do you feel that the attitude towards a black artist has changed at all, or is it pretty much the same?
Well, I believe it's changed plenty. I mean, you got, you know, 24/7 Spies, they've had a good run. Lenny Kravitz has had a good run. You've got some good people out there doing some good stuff. The reason why you don't see a lot of blacks doing it now is because they just choose not to. You know, even though we were like, instrumental in inventing it, you know, once black people move on to other things. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
We invent rock and roll, then we move into rhythm and blues. We perfect rhythm and blues, we move on to this. We move disco, then we move... So, you know, then they moved on to rap. We create stuff, discard stuff, and move on to the next piece of stuff. So, there's never been a bunch of black people jumping over themselves to play rock and roll.
Right.
Now is a great time to play it, because the market has never been more receptive. You know, you got some good people out there. Like, we're heavy admirers of King's X, okay? And I'm a big Doug Penix fan, you know. due to Doug Pinnick being in that band, a lot of times they're considered a black rock group. He's only one guy. It's a three piece. But you got their one brother in there, and they're like, oh, yeah, they're a black rock group. What are you talking about? He's only one guy.
Yeah.
You know, and you got Eric Gale. I mean, you got a lot of, you got more brothers now doing it. Okay? But you're not going to, I don't think you're ever going to see a proliferation of blacks playing rock and roll, because it's not something that we do as a people. You know, what was Hendrix's biggest problem with airplay in the 60s was that black radio stations wouldn't play his music. They just wouldn't do it. And he died before Band of Gypsies album came out, when he really would have had a chance to see black people show up at his concert. He didn't get a chance to see, you know, like when he did Who Knows and Machine Gun and With the Power of Soul and all that. He died before that hit the airwaves. Had he lived, he would have seen an audience filled with black people, because that's when they turned around.
And once you guys have this album of yours finished, and with all the songs that you're working on right now, what would you hope people come away with after they hear it?
Well, I'd hope that, first off, that they would just be entertained and like it. And second of all, that the message, the social message that's in the material, is felt and heard, and they go away with that. You know, I think, you know, again, using Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young as an example, I think what they had to say was more significant to them than anything else. You know, I mean, they were some powerful writers and said some powerful things. And so, you know, I'm not saying that we should, you know, I'd want to necessarily be that celebrated in that same sense, but I would hope that, one, people would be entertained, and two, that they would walk away being able to make sense of the message.
Yeah. The only thing I would add to that is that they be stimulated spiritually as well. You know, because one of the advantages of being our age and doing this is that we've lived long enough to acquire some wisdom. You know, and I, for one, believe that the minute you step on a stage and hold a mic, you are accountable for what you say. You are accountable for what you do. People are paying attention to you. They are listening to you. Some of them are patterning their lives after what you say. And with that comes awesome responsibility, man. You know.
And I think that too many of the people that have that responsibility don't live up to the integrity of what it is. A lot of artists just kind of throw it all away, piss it all away.
Yeah. And the fact that we're alive and having been through the battles, the individual battles that we've all been through, I mean, that's, once again, that's just a testimony to the glory of God. And I really want to, you know, write music that inspires people.
Check out the band at ims-1.com or friend them on Facebook. Here is veteran rock band once more with Old Song.
Do your best to send the kids off to school. touchdown king, superhero movie queen. Ooh. I said I'm rock star, touchdown king, superhero movie queen. Ooh. Touchdown gang, superhero movie queen. Ooh. I said I'm rock star, touchdown gang, superhero movie queen. Ooh. I said I'm rock star, touchdown gang, superhero movie queen. Ooh. I said I'm rock star. Touchdown gang, superhero movie queen. I said I'm rock star. Touchdown gang, superhero movie queen. Yeah, rock star. Touchdown gang, superhero movie queen.
That's going to do it for this edition of Rockwired Radio Profiles. A special thanks goes out to Maurice Ball and Alvin Grimes for their time and, more importantly, their music. For Rockwired, I'm Brian Lush, and remember, keep your eyes forward, never look back, and make it up as you go. Rockwired Radio Profiles is powered by Rockwired Media LLC, a limited liability company, and is available exclusively at rockwired.com. Online radio that rocks. Rock.